I'm Marty Moscowane. Welcome to Radio Times. It's been more than a week since Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf vetoed the entire $30.1 billion budget sent by the legislature that's controlled by the Republican Party. It included changes to the public pension system and a plan to privatize liquor sales. Wolf, a Democrat, said the math doesn't work and it doesn't address the challenges that Pennsylvanians face. We asked John Baer, columnist for the Philadelphia Daily News, to fill us in on the details of this standoff. And John, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times. Do we have John Baer? Do we have John Baer? We will get John Baer. In the meantime, I will open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. John, do we have you?
I can hear you.
Okay, well, I can hear you, so that's we're connected.
And good morning, Marty.
Good morning. How are you doing?
Good.
I'm good. Nice to have you back on the show.
Thank you.
So where do negotiations stand between the governor and the legislature, the Republican leadership in the legislature?
Right. Well, in this case, this is one of those rare cases where no news is bad news. There's literally nothing going on at the moment. Staff continue to talk, but the governor and the specific leaders of the Republican chambers are not meeting. The governor has taken back to his road tour and is out and about promoting his budget, as he has since he introduced it in March. And Republicans are pretty much sitting on their hands and sticking to their positions, and there doesn't seem to be anything close to an agreement.
Would it be fair to say that the Republicans, in a sense, vetoed Wolf's budget? Two very different approaches to spending and taxing.
Yep, no question. As we were waiting to come on here, the governor's office put out a statement that basically says Governor Wolf has reached out, but Republicans are bringing nothing to the table. And they make the argument that he has tried to compromise, even on the big Republican sticking points, which are the pension and liquor, but that they won't move at all. And so, you know, here we are.
Hmm. And what, just to, I guess, recap here, what Wolf proposed were some new and, I would say, increased taxes, a severance tax on natural gas, shifting away from property tax to more income tax, lots of this money going to the schools. Is that what the Republicans basically said no to?
Well, they said no to just about everything. There's a couple of oddities going on. One is Wolf did something that Governor Corbett could never do, and that's unite the Republicans. During the 4 years that Republican Governor Corbett was in office, Republicans could not agree on a liquor bill or a pension bill. They did both this time with a Democratic governor. Now, maybe it's because they figured he'd veto them both, and in fact, and he has. So maybe they weren't going out on such a limb. But the big sticking points right now are the governor wants to increase broad-based taxes, both sales and personal income. Republicans repeatedly and consistently have said, we're not going to do that. So then you need to look elsewhere for new revenue. And the only remaining big-ticket item is a tax on the extraction of severance shale. Gas, natural gas, you know,
right.
Marcellus shale.
Right.
I got a plane going over, Marty. Sorry.
That's all right. It's live radio. We're all about this. Go ahead, John.
So the governor has said, look, I need 5%. That'll give me $1 billion. I can restore the cuts that were made to education, particularly in Philadelphia. And the Republicans say, no, you don't need to do that because we can raise money by selling off the state stores, even if it's in a phase-in state. And so the shale thing becomes sort of a linchpin. When the governor says that he's willing to negotiate and compromise on shale, we take that to mean that he would go down a few percentages and get a little bit less money and then get a little bit more for schools. But right now they're still saying no to a shales tax. I think a shales tax is possible only because there remains a good deficit in the budget, and it's a structural deficit, and if you don't address it, it just builds and builds every year. But then again, when has government done things that are right?
Oh, dear. Well, you know, I can't, and you've probably been in part of some of these shows that we've done, John, over the years, how many shows we've talked about the plan to privatize or to sell off some of the state liquor stores in the state.
Yeah.
It has never happened. But do you think there is some negotiating wiggle room that if it's a severance tax and some version of selling off a piece of the state store system, I know people don't like that word, do you think there's some middle ground there, or am I being naive?
Well, I mean, there might be, maybe not so much on state stores, but on pensions. One of the pension bill that the Republicans have sent the governor has an element in it that would put all new employees, not current employees or retirees, but new employees, new school teachers and new state workers into a 401k type pension instead of the defined plan they're in now. I think that's possible only because, you know, and Wolf so far has opposed it. And people say, oh, it's because of his allegiance to the unions and the unions gave him money and all that. But the problem is, I mean, this guy is not a traditional politician. He did not come up through the Democratic Party. He did not need union money. He certainly didn't have it in the primary. He didn't need it in the general. He won't need it in his reelection campaign. So politically, he's in no real danger by doing something that the unions don't want and the Republicans do. So if there's a compromise point, I think that that might be it.
Do you think Wolf, in hindsight, could have done something different to sell the budget that he proposed earlier this year? As you said, he's not a traditional politician. In fact, this is his first elective job. Do you think, and I, having interviewed him, he talked about, you know, making friends and friends can talk to each other and resolve conflicts. Is that naive on his part, or do you think this could still work?
Well, I mean, he keeps referring to his experience in business and how he's negotiated for years and all of that. The difference, Marty, of course, and it's obvious, in business, everybody wants to make a profit. And so people will negotiate if there is a better chance of making a profit. In politics, nobody cares about a profit. They're going to get paid, they're going to get their perks and their pensions, no matter what happens, no matter who wins. Too many people in a lot of power have only a parochial interest in their own district and their own reelection. They don't care about profit. So, I mean, there's a big disconnect between Wolf saying, oh, I did this in business, I can do this in government. Business is not government, and I think that's a lesson that's hard learned, and I think it's one that he's starting to understand now.
What about state employees? I mean, at some point, are they not going to get paid if this standoff continues?
He's assured that that won't happen. I mean, there are ways that you can do continuing expenditures. I mean, revenue keeps coming in if there's no budget. It's not that people stop paying taxes. The only danger, and it would take several weeks, maybe a couple months, for you to feel some effect among providers, especially those nonprofits that provide human services, like to homelessness, to abuse centers and things like that, they will feel the pinch because they don't have wells of reserves. Mm. School districts, with the exception of Philadelphia, Reading, Chester, places like that, have reserve funds just for this purpose, and they can dip into those and go on without much notice. But there is some risk the longer it goes. And remember, I mean, we went through in Rendell's first year, 2003, which, oh my God, was what? Oof. 13 years ago, 12 years ago?
Something like that.
Went the whole way to December without a budget. And there are people that are predicting that that could happen here if there's not some kind of movement pretty soon.
You had an interesting interview with a governor where he talked about something called the Democratic deficit.
Yeah.
What did he mean by that? What is that?
The governor, in addition to his degree from the London School of Economics, also holds a Ph.D. in political science from MIT. And so he was using a political science term, democratic deficit, which generally applies to European governments and European economies that don't necessarily reflect the will of the majority of their residents and constituents. And he says that's what we're facing in Pennsylvania, that people know that schools need more money, that people know that shale should be taxed because we're the only big state that doesn't tax the industry. And according to the Wall Street Journal, Pennsylvania now trails only Texas in the production of natural gas. And so his argument is people want those things. The government doesn't, won't give it to them. And so there's this deficit in democracy. The difficulty is that if you poll people on other issues, such as pension, liquor, and taxes, they want pension reform, they want liquor reform, they don't want new taxes. So it's kind of a hair-splitting argument to say we are in a democracy deficit, but both sides are guilty of it.
Well, you even went a little further and looked at this study. It was done a couple of years ago by Columbia University, the democratic deficit in the states, looking at how states, compared to each other, compared to what the people want and what they get. How did Pennsylvania do?
Yeah, fascinating study. Two political scientists at Columbia University looked at all the states, and Pennsylvania was at the bottom, along with like Mississippi, with southern states and like that. We had a 33% rating, meaning that we do what our government does, what our people want, only 33% of the time. Mm. And Marty, as you and I have discussed for a lifetime,
there, seems that way sometimes.
There are so many areas in which that there's evidence of that. Take any kind of structural reform in the government, like term limits, like the size of the legislature, like the pension and perks that public officials get, like cracking down on crime and corruption in public life. I mean, there are so many areas, liquor stores, pensions, name it. I mean, pick your area. Education, the U.S. Department of Education says we have the worst balance of spending equity in America, in Pennsylvania. And so I think a lot of things that people want, our government doesn't give them. And so we have this deficit that's demonstrated by a national study.
Well, and just in the couple of minutes we have left looking at this this budget, do you anticipate, John, that this could go on for months? Or is there true pressure? I know there's some ad wars going up. Is there pressure on both sides to come to some kind of compromise?
Sure there is. But, the politics of it weigh more heavily on the governor. He's the face of the budget. People don't know who the state representatives are across the state. It's his state. It's his budget. The longer it goes without any resolution, and if there is some real damage done, it's going to be at his doorstep, not necessarily legislatures. That's not fair, but that's how it plays out. My solution is sell the state stores, legalize marijuana, let the state stores dispense marijuana. We would never have to tax anybody in the state again, and everybody'd be happy.
Now, you know the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, John Baer, probably more than anybody, and you know that will not happen in our lifetimes.
Hey, anybody
anyway.
Can dream, Mark.
One little quick thing before we say goodbye. I know that the governor reinstated the head of the Open Records Office. He withdrew his nominee to head up the state police department. Were those sweeteners in any way?
Sure. I mean, there's a lot of olive branches saying, look, I'm not going to be hardhead on anything, and here's two good examples. So come talk to me. Come play with me. I'm a reasonable person. I'm willing to compromise, and we can get this done. And he's demonstrated that on a number of levels. So far, the other side has not.
And does he have an ally at all within his own party and on the other side?
Well, sure. Most Democrats are standing with him. There was not a single Democratic vote for this budget. He will have a problem with broad-based taxes, particularly with Western Democrats who will not support that. I mean, the last person to get a broad-based tax increase was Ed Rendell. It was in his first year. It was that December budget, and he did get an increase in the personal income tax. But this is a different time, Marty. I mean, the per capita income in 2003, when Rendell did that, is actually higher than it is now.
Wow.
And so people still haven't come out of the recession in this state. There's a lot of areas that are still suffering. And a broad-based tax is going to be a very tough sell.
Well, John Baer, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today on
Radio
Times.
Marty, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. He's a columnist for the Philadelphia Daily News. You can read his blog, Baer Growls. Shifting gears after this very short break, we'll be talking about Bernie Sanders. He wants to be president of the United States. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome back, to Ballot Talks on Radio Times. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders' bid for the Democratic nomination for president has surprised a lot of people. He's been speaking to overflow crowds of enthusiastic supporters who love his message of political revolution. Here he is at a recent campaign rally in Portland, Maine.
From Maine to California, we have friends in Alaska and Hawaii as well. The American people understand that establishment politics and establishment economics is not working for the middle class. They understand that the greed of Wall Street and the greed of corporate America is destroying the great middle class of this country. And people are saying from coast to coast, you can't keep getting away with that.
Today we take a look at Bernie Sanders' candidacy, his viability for office, and what his popularity among progressive voters means for the Democratic Party and, frankly, for Hillary Rodham Clinton's campaign. Joining us are John Nichols. He's a writer for The Nation. In fact, had a cover story, an interview with Bernie Sanders recently, co-founder of the Free Press, also associate editor for the Capital Times. John Nichols, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be with you, Marty.
And also with us is Josh Crosshar, and he's a politics editor for the National Journal. He writes a weekly column called Against the Grain. And Josh Crosshar, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Good to be here, Marty.
Let me begin with you, John, only because you sat down with Bernie Sanders recently, did a pretty extensive interview with him. Is he also surprised about these overflow crowds?
That's a very good place to begin. Look, I've known Bernie Sanders for a very, very long time. I've covered him in a lot of settings, interviewed him many times, interviewed him in public settings, introduced him at events, moderated panels he's been on. I've been around the guy in an awfully lot of settings. And so I was very intrigued at this point, you know, sitting down with him as he's actually started to, you know, get a little bit of traction. What did he think about all this? What I was struck by was that he was, I think a fair word would be delighted. I mean, he was happy.
I'm sure he
about
is,
it,
yes.
As any candidate would be. But by the same token, I was intrigued that he seemed very much to be the same guy. There wasn't a real shift in his demeanor, a shift in his style. And my sense is that at some point, yeah, I actually, for a while, I didn't necessarily think he was going to do this. Mm-hmm. I did an interview with him a year ago, and he said he was prepared to run. But I kind of thought it wasn't going to happen. And I think at a certain point, he decided to go for it, to make the run. And he was going to do it his way. And so far, he has been rewarded for that. And, you know, when a candidate's in that zone, they're very upbeat. Although, I think you have that, you know, things can change quickly in politics.
Well, so indeed, yes.
When we interview him next time, it could be different.
Exactly. This is a very fluid situation. To you, Josh, I mean, it seems like he has tapped into the kind of frustration I think that many people, probably a lot of progressive Democrats, but I think even more than that, the frustration with our economic system, the income inequality, the lobbyists that seem to control so much of our political system, the fact that there are so many more rich people in this country seem to be doing very well while the middle class and others really struggle to try to stay afloat. Is that a legitimate concern, do you think? And do you think he represents that?
Absolutely, on both counts. I mean, he represents the id of the Democratic Party's base. And the fact that a self-proclaimed socialist is winning over a third of the vote in New Hampshire and gaining ground quite fast in Iowa is testament to both how the Democratic Party has shifted to the left under the last 8 years of the Obama administration, and also how much hunger there is for someone who speaks his mind, who's much more to the left of Hillary Clinton, who seems to be poll testing a lot of her responses. And she announced her campaign and has not been nearly as accessible as Bernie Sanders has been both in the presidential campaign and throughout his congressional career. And, you know, the Democratic Party has always had a progressive element, in especially in the primaries. You look at Howard Dean in 2004, Gary Hart in the 1980s, Bill Bradley 2000. But Bernie Sanders is far more liberal and also far less electable in many strategists' minds. So the fact that he is gaining ground and is posing a threat to Hillary Clinton in both Iowa and New Hampshire really tells you something about where the Democratic Party is at this moment in time.
Well, and Josh, for the non-Freudians in our audience, when you describe him as the id of the Democratic Party, what do you mean politically speaking?
I think their ideology is closer in many ways to Bernie Sanders's, but they think Hillary Clinton is more electable. And I think it's hard to see Hillary Clinton after Iowa and New Hampshire losing states where we're featuring more diverse electorates, both ideologically and demographically. Bernie Sanders is doing well in states that have very progressive bases and are very homogenous. Iowa and New Hampshire are among the whitest Democratic electorates in the entire country. And Bernie Sanders has struggled to win much support among African-American voters, among Hispanic voters. And that's one of his biggest challenges if he does continue this momentum.
Well, let me turn to you, John. And this is something I've been looking for a while for someone to answer this question for me. If Bernie Sanders is a socialist, why is he allowed to run as a Democrat? And if he were running on the Socialist Party ticket, Would he have the same response to his candidacy?
Those are a couple of terrific questions. And let me also mention that I'm delighted to be on with Josh because I am a big fan of his analysis, both of the Democratic race and the Republican race. And so I think his insights are very sound here. Let's talk about a couple of realities. First off, in the United States, we have a structural bias in favor of a two-party system. And if somebody runs as a Green, a Libertarian, a Socialist, an Independent, they begin with enormous challenges. And so when you ask if he would be doing as well running as a third-party candidate, I would argue no. He might well be drawing the crowds. Remember that when Ralph Nader ran as a Green in 2000, he had super rallies that drew thousands and thousands of people. And there's a lot of evidence that many of the people who came to the rallies didn't necessarily vote for him, right? They were enthusiastic, they were thrilled, but at the end of the day, many of them ended up voting for Al Gore, I would presume. And so the challenge of a third-party run, a socialist party run, is particularly difficult. The last socialist to really get a meaningful vote in the U.S. was Norman Thomas in 1932.
Oh, yikes.
Got almost a million votes, influenced Franklin Roosevelt. So now let's look at why run in the Democratic zone. First off, it's possible for somebody to run in the Democratic caucuses and primaries who has not always been a Democrat. I would note that this year, Hillary Clinton, who began as a Goldwater Republican, is running as a Democrat. Lincoln Chafee, who was a Republican senator and an independent governor, is running as a Democrat. And so, you know, people come into this process, you know, from a lot of different places. Sanders is interesting because he has been so resolutely an independent, not an active member of the Socialist Party, actually serving as an independent, but I think making a practical choice that if you're going to impact the process, the place to do it is within the primaries, in the primary process. And the final note I'll add there is that running as a socialist in the Democratic zone, in the Democratic primaries, is not unheard of. I mean, we have had, you know, there have been members of Democratic Socialists of America who have served in Congress, people like Ron Dellums. And going back a long way, there have been people like Dan Hoehn, the former mayor of Milwaukee, who was a Democratic nominee for governor of Wisconsin a couple times. So this is it's somewhat rare, but it's certainly not unheard of for socialists and social Democrats to run within the Democratic Party.
Josh, let me quote something that you wrote recently about Bernie Sanders. You said Sanders is a weak challenger. He's got an unhealthy mix of Donald Trump's ego and Michelle Bachmann's bombast. He won statewide office in Vermont, the most liberal state in the country, with a population smaller than Bachmann's old congressional district. I mean, we know now what Donald Trump has been saying and, frankly, lying about in the last couple of weeks. Are you calling him a liar?
No, but from a political point of view, from an electability standpoint in a November general election, it would be hard to find many Democratic or even progressive strategists who would think Bernie Sanders would be the toughest candidate for a Republican to beat, even with Hillary Clinton's well-known vulnerabilities that we've seen in the last few weeks. I do think, though, that the one thing, and you hinted at this with Donald Trump, but the one thing that he has going for him, and it's a very undervalued asset in American politics these days, is authenticity. Mm. And at a time, I mean, both Democrats and Republicans alike, when staffers are shielding their candidate from media scrutiny, when you have these canned responses, and Hillary Clinton's not giving many national interviews at all, she's avoiding the press, you have the leading Republican candidate candidates who are very, very cautious about granting interviews and really keeping their candidates to the strict talking points that they have prepared for them. Bernie Sanders is a breath of fresh air in that regard. He goes to these big rallies, town halls throughout the country. He speaks his mind. And there's a level of authenticity that you just don't – you saw this a lot more a couple decades ago in politics, but it's so rare to see these days in terms of how controlling the advisors are to their candidates. So Bernie Sanders represents that sort of unvarnished authenticity. And there's a real vacuum of that in American politics today, and he's really reacting and responding to that market vacuum.
Let me just quickly reintroduce the two of you. That's Josh Kroshar, and he's a politics editor for the National Journal. He also writes a weekly column called Against the Grain. John Nichols with us as well. He's a writer for The Nation, co-founder of The Free Press, associate editor for The Capital Times. And we are talking about the Bernie Sanders bid for the White House for the Democratic nomination for president. I think many people have been surprised, although some are not, about his overflow crowds. He's also been raising a fair amount of money, which, of course, is the lifeblood of politics in this country. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email. I see people already are. RadioTimes@WHYY.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. John, let me read a Facebook comment for you from Dave. He says, the groundswell response to Bernie Sanders is simply true progressive Democrats and others finally finding someone to give voice to their concerns on a national level, as opposed to the party-anointed bankster paid for neoliberal Hillary Clinton. What are your thoughts about that, John?
Well, that certainly sounds like a Sanders backer.
It sure does. It sure does.
Look, here's the interesting thing about it, and I think Josh hit on so many important elements of this. There are real doubts on the part of a lot of people about whether Bernie Sanders will go beyond what's happening right now, which is drawing together a very passionate set of progressive base voters, getting them out, giving them a message that is very appealing to them. And frankly, I would emphasize, at some of these events, drawing a lot of working class folks who don't always show up at rallies. And that's an interesting element of it, that he clearly is, you know, making connections beyond just the usual suspects. But still, it's a huge leap to go from, you know, hitting all those marks message-wise to seriously competing in the intense multi-state primaries and caucuses that go on. For Sanders, I think you hit on something that's important in one of your earlier questions. And that is that, you know, you said that, you know, he's still got a lot of work to do, mm-hmm. reaching out to African-American community, Latino community, communities, folks who live in places that aren't very much like Vermont. And the key to that is something that has, to my mind, very little to do with Sanders, very much to do with the moment that we are in. Sanders himself says that there has to be a political revolution for him to be even, you know, minimally viable. Things really have to change. And I think a lot of people assume that he would be the one that would change it. I don't think that's a possibility at all. I think the reality is that there are a lot of economic issues that have been profoundly unaddressed in America for a long time. There is a lot of anger. There's a lot of deep, deep concern that crosses lines of race, that crosses lines of region, ethnicity. And the question that we face is this the year when that really takes off, that it really becomes central to our politics? If it is, someone is going to connect on that. And whether Sanders plays the role that you saw with Paul Tsongas back in 1992, where he ran for president, talked a lot about deficits, mm-hmm. talked a lot about balanced budgets. Mm-hmm. He didn't win. But boy, did he define the template for that year and for some time beyond. It's always the question of whether a candidate sort of frames the issues, as I think Sanders is to a large extent now, or whether they become the embodiment of those issues and go much further. And I think that's what Josh is getting at as well, that you know, we're in a zone here where we don't know exactly how far all this will go.
Well, Josh, even picking up on John's interview with Bernie Sanders, and he talked about his civil rights record, you look at the audiences at his campaign rallies, largely white. It looks like students, maybe 20-somethings, and then some boomers sprinkled in there. How much of a I don't know if it's problem is exactly the right word, but how much of a challenge is it to speak to minorities within the Democratic Party that play such an important role?
Well, this is not a new challenge. There's always been a progressive, largely white constituency within the Democratic Party that gets energy in the early states. You can go back to 1968 with Gene McCarthy. You can look at 2004 and Howard Dean. Bill Bradley, like I said, in 2000, they've all had very similar bases of support. They do well with college students. They do well with the most progressive elements within the party. And usually these constituencies are predominantly white. So this is not a new phenomenon, though I think it is in a more intense and Bernie Sanders is such a unique political figure. He's so authentic and so unconstrained by the normal political templates of our time that it makes it a lot more interesting, especially that he's running against Hillary Clinton. John mentioned 1992 as a template for sort of the moment we're in right now, and I totally agree with that. And I think the Republican side that year in that presidential election, when you had a sitting president in George H.W. Bush, who was having real trouble both economically and also from the more outspoken populist wing of the Republican Party back then, and he faced a real serious challenge from Pat Buchanan in New Hampshire in 1992. And Pat Buchanan didn't win the primary, but the fact that he got a significant share of the vote against a sitting president in a state that didn't even seem to be competitive before the election was held, that could be the closest parallel, I think, that we could have to Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. Sanders is unlike – I mean, there's a chance he could win. If he won, that would be a monumental upset in New Hampshire. But if he comes within, you know, single digits of Hillary Clinton in New Hampshire, it would be a real big red flag to the Democratic Party that Hillary Clinton might not be as strong of a candidate, especially with the base, as she's been cracked up to be, and also some real general election fears that is Hillary Clinton really the best and strongest candidate to go up against whoever the Republicans put up.
And Josh, we're almost up in a break here. Of course, New Hampshire right next door to Vermont. I assume that gives him a little bit of a leg up.
Yeah, it does. And Howard Dean had that same – Howard Dean had something of the opposite experience, also from Vermont. And he had the similar constituency and the similar home and regional base of support, though he underachieved and ended up not doing well and having to drop out soon thereafter. So there's really a lot of energy in New Hampshire. It is Bernie Sanders' home base, and he should do well. If he comes within single digits, I think it would have a seismic impact in the Democratic field.
Well, let's take that short break, and we'll get back to our conversation. It's Ballot Talks on Radio Times, the hour we set aside to talk about politics. We are talking about Bernie Sanders with Josh – excuse me, I keep screwing up your name there, and I do apologize for that. Josh Kroshar, and he's politics editor for the National Journal. Also with us, John Nichols. He's a writer for The Nation and also associate editor for the Capital Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times. Actually, it's Ballot Talks on Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscowen, and I'm talking with Josh Kroshar and also with John Nichols about Bernie Sanders. Do you want to vote for Bernie Sanders? Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Let me play another clip, and this is Missouri Senator Claire McCaskill, and she's discussing Bernie Sanders on a recent edition of MSNBC's Morning Joe.
I think the media is giving Bernie a pass right now. I very rarely read in any coverage of Bernie that he's a socialist. I think everybody wants a fight, and I think they are not really giving the same scrutiny to Bernie Sanders that they're giving to certainly Hillary Clinton and the other candidates. So she's going to win this, and as soon as I think they begin treating him like a serious candidate instead of, oh my gosh, it's so great, we've got a fight in the Democratic Party, I think it will become very clear. Any other candidate that had the numbers that Hillary Clinton had right now would be talked about as absolutely untouchable, and all of a sudden, oh, Bernie.
Right.
I think it's I think Bernie is too liberal to gather enough votes in this country to become president, and I think Hillary Clinton is going to be a fantastic president.
Well, John, do you think the press has been too easy on Bernie and too hard on Hillary?
There's a lot of pieces of that question.
Yes.
First off, I was amazed by the suggestion that nobody's mentioned that he's a socialist. To me, it seems like it's been the great feature element of every story. It's the interesting thing about Bernie Sanders, one of the many interesting things. But yeah, I mean, it's one of the first things you asked about right here. So I think her assessment is wrong in that regard. I think the media has presented Sanders pretty much as who he is and what he says, and he's developed a good deal of traction there. One thing I would counsel on, too, mm-hmm. I think a lot of people think Bernie Sanders simply just appeared out of the blue, like, wow, who is this guy? The reality is he's been in Congress 25 years. and he has been a staple of progressive media. Tom Hartman's radio show, some of the MSNBC shows, other places, and so you know he is known out there by a lot of folks, and I think that underpins some of the energy that's seen that made some folks seem like it's just being built up by the media. But here's the other element. I think it is fair to say that the coverage of Sanders will change and will evolve if he gets as close as Josh is suggesting and others, if he gets that close in New Hampshire. And one element that I'd throw in the mix here is that we keep talking about Iowa and New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
Notice the other places that Sanders is going. He went to Maine and had a huge rally. He went to Colorado and had a huge rally. He went to Minnesota and had a huge rally. Some of these states are very early caucus states. They come after Iowa and New Hampshire, but they're very early on at least the existing schedule. And so don't presume that if Sanders does get traction in Iowa and New Hampshire, that he won't post some surprising wins in some other, or at least strong showings in some other places. At that point, if he really is starting to, either have strong showings or wins in a number of states, then I think the media scrutiny is going to be very, very intense. And I think that there will be challenges to him, not so much on his personality or his style, as on the issues. And ultimately, that's what a political campaign should be about, debate about issues.
And Josh, picking up on what John just said, 25 years in Congress, I was reading in preparation for the show that no one in Congress has endorsed Bernie Sanders yet. I don't know, is that significant? Is it not significant? Of course, we're a year out from most of the primaries and things like that.
Yeah, it really isn't all that significant, especially given how early we are in the process and how you would expect Clinton, because of her establishment credentials, to get the lion's share of congressional endorsements. But even on the Republican side, even someone like a Jeb Bush hasn't locked up too many members of Congress at this point in the game. I think it's interesting that Claire McCaskill said that Bernie Sanders hasn't been criticized. In large part, that's because Hillary Clinton has chosen not to criticize him. She's worried about attacking Bernie Sanders because she thinks that actually could draw him more support from the progressive base. It can draw him more support and more attention that she doesn't want to give to him. But in large part, the media, and I think there has been some scrutiny, but the media hasn't done what McCaskill describes because Clinton herself hasn't chosen to go after him. And there is fodder that someone like a Clinton could use, and probably most significantly, he at one point in time was supported by had some support from the NRA. His Republican opponent in 1992, when he first was elected to the House, actually was opposed by the NRA and helped elect Sanders to Congress. Hmm. And his vote on Vermont's sort of a unique state politically where you can be very, very liberal but still support Second Amendment rights. And Sanders' vote against the Brady Bill and some other gun rights votes are very logical attack lines for someone like Hillary Clinton. But she's chosen not to, at least at this early stage, go after him because she's hoping that he'll peter out on his own or that his ceiling will be low enough that she can glide by. I don't know if that's going to be the case, and I think I wouldn't be surprised if in the next few months you do see some more sustained attacks from the Clinton camp on Bernie Sanders.
I do want to get to our callers, but I have an email that I really
one.
Let me just read an email very quickly, an email from Lindsay. She says, I like Sanders' politics, but I'm suspicious of any candidate who doesn't brush his hair. Smiley face. John?
It's very funny. There are now T-shirts that have sort of the outline of Sanders' hairline.
Right?
Like this sort of that are actually quite artfully done. But if I could just come off one thing that Josh said there that I think is important.
Sure.
As regards Hillary Clinton's interaction with Bernie Sanders and, frankly, with Martin O'Malley, who will be in the debates as well and who has been very pointed in a lot of his statements. When you go on the floor of a Democratic National Convention, the delegates are way more progressive than the nominee. That's almost always the case. When I go on the floor of a Republican National Convention, the delegates are way more conservative than the nominee. That is almost always the case. A smart candidate, this being in Hillary Clinton's position, is you don't want to put yourself so at odds with your more progressive opponent if you're a Democrat, your more conservative opponent if you're a Republican, that you really do start to lose the connection with that base of the party. And so I think Clinton is walking a line here, actually adopting some language and moving around Sanders on some issues. Don't presume that she isn't responding simply because it isn't negative. You know, there are ways to, you know, take some issues, highlight some other issues, and I think in her view, hopefully still keep a good tie to the base.
Let me get Karen from Westchester to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Karen. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Just wanted to say I'm really proud of my Bernie sticker on my car. It's the only one I've seen out here in Chester County, and I get tons of favorable comments and questions about it. And there are many, many people who love Bernie who feel totally excluded from both of the major parties. I'm the mother of a millennial. I know lots of millennials whom Bernie represents and the major parties don't, and I think that's a big issue. Finally, he's talking about inequality in a very real way, which I don't think the other candidates are. I think that's where he's a real winner. And one final comment. I'll take Bernie's hair over Donald Trump's hair anyway.
Karen, I was waiting for that comment. Just one quick question. No, just one quick question before you go, though. As you said, you really mistrust the two mainstream parties. He is running as a Democrat. You know that, right?
Yeah, I know he is. And he represents a sector. I understand why he's running as a Democrat. Where else do you go? If you're not a Democrat or a Republican, your campaign means nothing in this country. You're excluded in Pennsylvania primaries, for example. And that's one reason, you know, that a lot of us are for Bernie. We know he represents something that the major parties do not really allow. And the only way to get Democrats to respond to what many of us care about is for someone like a Bernie or a Ralph Nader or a Howard Dean to run. We know that from history. I've been around long enough to know that. So I keep my party registration Democratic, not because I feel like a Democrat. I feel more like a Democratic socialist. But how else can I participate?
I hear you. And that's very true here in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Yep. Let me give you, Josh, a chance to respond to Karen's comment. And I do want to quote something that you wrote. But she does represent, I think, a very frustrated wing of the party.
There are a lot of frustrated voters. I mean, it's remarkable going back to the end of the Bush administration till, you know, 2006 or so. There's almost been 10 years of disaffection from the electorate. People in both parties don't like Washington. They don't trust politicians, and they don't like what they see from. I mean, you look at the approval and favorability ratings from all the candidates running, and almost all of them are negative. The state of politics in most voters' minds is abysmal, and that's where Sanders has a whole lot of appeal. I do think the one thing to watch, and John alluded to it earlier in the show. White working class voters have been everyone assumes that they've been drifting to the Republican Party, and they have. But it's interesting that when you actually look at their ideology, it's a lot more socially conservative. But when it comes to fiscal issues, Bernie Sanders' rhetoric isn't all that disconnected from where they feel personally. And if you look at some states that still have a decent share of working class voters that are remaining registered with the Democratic Party, states like Pennsylvania, for example, some of the caucus states that are also up on the ballot. There's a real opportunity because Hillary Clinton is certainly going to try to win over female voters, and she's going to try to run up the score with non-white voters. But there is a potential appeal that the connection that John was alluding to with white working class male voters that have left the Democratic Party, but they might see some connection on the fiscal side of issues that they like from Bernie Sanders, and they may end up supporting him in some of these primaries.
Just a quick quote from some of what you've written about Bernie Sanders and I guess his supporters. You say this newly aggressive grassroots are letting their ideology blind them to the political realities of the moment. I mean, are you saying that this is sort of a quixotic losing cause?
Well, that's a political phenomenon we've seen in both parties. The Tea Party for the Republicans was also sort of the parallel worldview on the Republican side, where political pragmatism and the candidates that were the most outspoken and the most conservative, or like a Ted Cruz, for example, are the ones that tend to do best politically, at least in the short term. So, I mean, again, electability. Even at Bernie Sanders' high moment, even if he wins the New Hampshire primary, hypothetically, I don't think many Democrats would consider him a strong general election candidate against Jeb Bush, against Marco Rubio, against Scott Walker even. They think he has an appeal with the base of the party, but there's only so far, politically speaking, appealing to the base can go.
John, let me read a comment from Jonathan. He says, there's nothing left-wing about Bernie Sanders' common-sense centrist policies. Since when did concepts like protecting Social Security and Medicare become left-wing? When did investing in America infrastructure and education become left-wing, he asks. Your thoughts?
That nails it. Because one of the complexities of this discussion we've had is an assumption that what Sanders is saying is just some sort of pure left-wing template. The fact of the matter is, most of what he's talking about polls incredibly well. I mean, these are not radical concepts. They only seem radical because most of the media in the United States covers politics in such a narrow range that it doesn't bring in, really a lot of ideas that Americans, frankly, comfortably entertain. And so that's what you see with Sanders. He is opening up discussions and, frankly, I think freeing up other people in the Democratic Party to move into a little more space. But let me offer one other element here that I think is important, and it relates to the caller we had just a moment ago. Yesterday, Marty, you and I were talking on the phone, preparing for this interview, preparing for this conversation. As I was walking, talking on my cell phone, and you were talking about, how big this thing really is. I was going, a bus stopped. I was walking around a neighborhood, a bus stopped. A kid got off the bus wearing a Bernie Sanders t-shirt, and it struck me that when you see that level of grassroots activity going on, it's about more than just left-right. And obviously that's anecdotal. There are a lot of people who I think are incredibly desperate to have a politics that means something to them. And I like it when people are blinded by their ideology and don't think about electability. That's something you should do at some point in the process. Yes, as you get closer to an election, you may make pragmatic or practical choices. You may choose what is sometimes referred to as the lesser of two evils. But should we really tell people, early on in the process, months before any caucuses or primaries, in either party, Democrat or Republican, that you should just be a pundit, that you should just worry about, who looks like they can win? Why not explore the issues? Why not, have big, bold debates? I think that's what Sanders is bringing to the Democratic side, along with Martin O'Malley, who I give credit in this regard as well.
Well, and to you, Josh, a minute before we have to say goodbye, do you think Bernie Sanders' candidacy is good for Hillary Rodham Clinton's candidacy?
I think she could use competition, though. I mean, Sanders is only one candidate, and historically you see much more competition within an open-seat Democratic primary. And I think, look at the CNN interview she did that was pretty shaky this week, and the lack of time she's giving to media outlets. I think she could use the competition, broadly speaking, and the fact that you have only Bernie Sanders and Martin O'Malley just hasn't really caught on fire at this point. I think she could use a lot more competition for sure, and I think she could be in for a lot of rustiness if she is the nominee without having that degree of competition.
And just one thing, John, we can't really talk about it, but in your interview with him, he wants Republicans included in the debate. So Republicans and Democrats debating each other even before there are primary elections. Interesting.
I would simply say that Bernie Sanders, as I think Josh knows, he really likes to debate, and I think he would love to have some debates with the Republicans.
Well, my thanks to both of you for joining us on Ballot Talks and Radio Times, talking about Bernie Sanders. John Nichols, thanks so much.
Pleasure.
And he's a writer for The Nation, associate editor for The Capital Times. And Josh Crosshair, thank you very much for joining us as well.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. Politics editor for the National Journal, and he writes a weekly column called Against the Grain. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program. Looks like we have a good conversation taking place on our Facebook page about Bernie Sanders. I'm Marty Moscowen, and do stay with us for the second hour of Radio Times. We'll be right back.